The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
This week, workers for the United States Census Bureau will try to count homeless Americans. The U.S. Constitution requires that a full census, or count, of the country's population take place every 10 years. The numbers help officials to shape congressional representation and decide how to spend federal money. Al Fontenot is the associate director of the U.S. Census Bureau. He spoke to an advisory committee last week. He said the Bureau has identified about 49,000 places across the U.S. where homeless people will be counted. The places include more than 33,000 camps, almost 10,000 shelters, and 5,000 soup kitchens. Counting the homeless is one of the hardest jobs for the U.S. Census Bureau. The effort is beginning 6 months later than planned because of the COVID-19 health crisis. Fontenot said, "We are making every effort to make sure that no one is left out of the count." The delay means workers will be on the job during warmer weather when homeless people are spread out across larger areas. Also, most homeless shelters are only operating at 25% to 50% capacity because of coronavirus restrictions. Some homeless activists worry that the Census Bureau will not count the whole homeless population. Mike Arnold leads aid group Midnight Mission. It provides beds, meals, and drug abuse treatment on Skid Row, a poor area in Los Angeles. Arnold said, "The best time to count is when it's cold and when it's dark, the way the county's count is done. Fewer people are moving around and people are bedded down." Beth Shin is a professor at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee who researches homelessness. She said, "Trying to count people living outdoors will be hard. People find places to be that aren't necessarily visible," Shin said. The homeless count is starting as the Census Bureau's effort to count people living in what is called transitory housing ends this month. About 12,500 census takers started visiting more than 60,000 RV parks, campgrounds, marinas, and hotels where people often live temporarily. All field operations for the 2020 census are set to end September 30th. For the homeless count, if someone is sleeping, a census taker will count them without getting information about their age, race, sex, or ethnic identity. Nowhere in the U.S. is the homeless crisis more visible than in Los Angeles. There, Hundreds of people live in temporary shelters. A count last January by the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority reported that there were more than 66,400 homeless people living in Los Angeles County. That is an increase of more than 12% from the year before. The wildfires in California only add to the difficulty of getting an exact count. California Democrat Jimmy Gomez is a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He wonders if many people in the state will be counted at all. That is a big concern with wildfires raging across California, he said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Today, let me start with a question. What do the following three statements have in common?
You are learning about grammar.
The president's words were shocking.
I smelled food burning in the kitchen.
Did you find the commonality? You may have noted that there is an ing word in each sentence. Learning, exciting, and burning. These are examples of the present participle, a word form that ends in ing and has a specific purpose in a sentence. Present participles can refer to the present, past, or future. I hope the meaning of that becomes clearer over the next few minutes. On this Everyday Grammar program, we will talk about three uses for present participles. Let's start with continuous verb tenses. As a reminder, a continuous tense is one that includes the verb be plus the ing form of a verb. There are six continuous tenses in English. Some are more common than others. You do not need to learn them all to understand the present participle. Continuous tenses can describe present, past, or future actions or events. Now, let's think about an example from earlier. Listen closely for the verb.
You are learning about grammar.
Here, the speaker used the present continuous verb tense. Notice that the verb be appears in the present form are, and the verb teach is in present participle form teaching. Now, listen to an example about something that already happened.
I was watching a movie when you called.
In the first part of the sentence, the speaker used the verb was watching, which is the past continuous tense. Notice that the verb be appears in the past form was. Yet the verb watch still appears in present participle form watching. Now let's turn to verbs of perception, also known as sense verbs. These are verbs that describe experiences we have through the physical senses of sight, sound, touch, smell, and taste. We sometimes use the present participle after sense verbs. Listen for the sense verb and the present participle in this sentence, which you heard earlier.
I smelled food burning in the kitchen.
Here, the sense verb is smell, and the sentence is about something that happened in the past. The speaker used the verb burn in its present participle form, burning. Notice that the sentence structure is sense verb plus object plus present participle. The object in the speaker sentence is food. After sense verbs, use of the present participle shows that the speaker experienced only part of what happened. It emphasizes that an action was in progress or not finished when a speaker experienced it. Here is another example that involves a sense verb and the present participle.
I heard the woman talking about the election.
The sense verb here is heard, and the verb talk is in present participle form, talking. The object is the woman. Use of the present participle talking here suggests the speaker only heard part of what was said. And finally, we move to adjectives that end in ing, also known as present participial adjectives. Do not worry. You do not need to remember that term. Just remember that in English, some adjectives end in ing. We usually use these adjectives to describe a person, thing, or idea that causes a feeling or emotion. In one of our earlier examples, you heard the adjective shocking. Listen to it again and take mental note of what caused the emotion.
The president's words were shocking.
The speaker is saying that she felt shocked by something. The president's words. Participial adjectives appear in the same position in sentences that normal adjectives do, after linking verbs such as be and before nouns. In this final example, listen for the ing adjective and the noun that follows.
That boring online class put me to sleep.
Did you find the adjective? It was boring, and it came before the noun online classes. Remember that ing adjectives describe the cause for an emotion. In this case, the online class caused the speaker to feel bored. And that's our program for this week. I'm Alice Bryant.
Are you at risk of getting seriously ill from the new coronavirus? Here are some things to keep in mind. 80% of coronavirus cases are mild. Young and healthy people are at low risk. Other people and those with serious health conditions have a greater risk of serious illness or even death. If you have a cough, fever, and difficulty breathing, contact the doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the World Health Organization website at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
From From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. John Quincy Adams was sworn in as President of the United States on March 4, 1825. A big crowd came to the Capitol building for the ceremony. All the leaders of government were there, senators, congressmen, Supreme Court justices, and James Monroe. Monroe's two terms as president were ending. President-elect Adams focused his inaugural address on unity. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific." He noted that during the past 10 years, political party differences had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. Adams closed his speech by recognizing that he was a minority president. No candidate had received a majority of electoral votes. So the House of Representatives had to make the decision. The House chose Adams as the next president. He told the crowd gathered at the Capitol that he needed the help of everyone in the years to come. Presidents-elect used to give their inaugural address before their swearing in. So after his speech, John Quincy Adams took the oath of office that made him the sixth president of the United States. His father was John Adams, the second president. John Quincy's mother, Abigail, made sure he received an excellent education. Historian Harlow Giles Unger wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. Quincy, incidentally, is how the family pronounced it. The historian tells this story about Abigail Adams and her son in 1775 in Massachusetts during the Revolutionary War.
When her firstborn son, John Quincy, was seven, they heard the cannon fire in the distance. They went up to the top of the hill behind their farmhouse and could look across Boston Harbor and see the Battle of Bunker Hill. And she took her boy by the hand. They went back down to the house, and she started melting down the family pewter with John Quincy helping her and making musket balls for the American Revolutionary troops.
Abigail and John Adams were strong patriots. They were one of the founding families of America. Harlow Giles Unger says Abigail Adams raised John Quincy to serve his country.
She told her son that if you do not grow up to be a great leader of this country, it will be because of your own laziness and obstinacy. She and her husband, John Adams, at that point decided to raise their son to be the President of the United States.
As a boy, John Quincy Adams learned to speak at least four languages and read Greek and Latin. He studied Shakespeare's plays. He traveled in Europe. He worked with his father in American consulates and embassies. He graduated from Harvard and was working as a lawyer by the age of 23.
He was a brilliant, brilliant young boy and man.
For about 25 years, Adams held mostly appointed jobs. He was ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812 between Britain and the United States. And he served 8 years as Secretary of State. Adams spent most of his career working in public service. Harlow Giles Unger says he could be impatient, especially with lawmakers.
He despised most of the politicians he met in Congress because he found them to be ignorant and self-serving, with no sense of patriotism and sense of obligation to the nation.
John Quincy Adams did not care for political battles. When he became president, he tried to bring his political opponents and the different parts of the country together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve. And although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas about the national government. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited only to making laws to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. Many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed that these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected Adams' proposals. Harlow Giles Unger says some of the disagreements during Adams' presidency helped start the American Civil War more than 30 years later in 1861.
The country was now splitting. Most of the South, had never accepted the Constitution as such. The Constitution did away with state sovereignty, but many Americans never accepted that, and especially in the South.
The political picture in the United States began to change during the administration of John Quincy Adams. His opponents won control of both houses of Congress in the elections of 1826. Adams' opponents called themselves Democrats. They supported Andrew Jackson and wanted him to win the next presidential election. Democrats needed the support of both the West and the South to elect Jackson. So they proposed a bill that appeared to help the West. The bill involved import taxes. A number of Western states wanted duties on industrial goods imported from other countries. The purpose was to protect their own industries. Southern states, however, opposed the import duties. They produced no industrial goods that needed protection. They argued that the Constitution did not give the government in Washington the right to approve such taxes. The Democrats expected Congress to defeat the bill they proposed. They thought the West would be grateful that the Democrats had tried to help them, and the South would be happy that there would be no import taxes. But to the Democrats' surprise, many congressmen from the Northeast joined with lawmakers from the West to support the bill. They did so even though the bill would harm industries in the Northeast. The Northerners wanted to keep the idea of protective trade taxes alive. The bill passed in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. This left President Adams with a difficult decision. Should he sign it into law, or should he veto it? If he signed the bill, it would show he believed that the Constitution allowed protective duties. That decision would create even more opposition to him in the South. If he vetoed it, then he would lose support in the West and Northeast. Adams signed the bill, but he made clear that Congress was fully responsible for it. Democrats in Congress made other attempts to weaken support for Adams. For example, they claimed that he was misusing government money. They tried to show that he and his father before him had become rich from government service. Others accused him of giving government jobs to his supporters. This charge was false. Top administration officials had urged Adams to give government jobs only to men who were loyal to him. But Adams had refused. He felt that as long as someone had done nothing wrong, he should continue in his job. During his 4 years as president, Adams removed 12 people from government jobs. In each case, the person had failed to do his work or had done something criminal. Adams often gave jobs to people who did not support him politically. He believed it was wrong to give a person a job just for political reasons. Many of Adams' supporters could not understand. They had worked hard to get him elected. Their support for him cooled. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many had for him.
His presidency was a complete failure. He was able to accomplish nothing.
The political battle between Adams' Republican Party and Jackson's Democrats remained bitter. Perhaps the worst fighting took place in the press. Each side had its own newspaper for support. The Daily National Journal supported the administration. The United States Telegraph supported Andrew Jackson. At first, the pro-administration newspaper called for national unity and an end to personal attacks. Then things changed. The paper had to defend against charges of political wrongdoing within Adams' party. It needed to turn readers away from these problems. So it printed a pamphlet that had been used against Andrew Jackson during an election campaign. The pamphlet accused Jackson of many bad things. The most damaging part involved the wife of another man. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.